Good morning. May it please the Court, Jennifer Wasson of Potter Anderson on behalf of Appellants RBC Capital Markets. With me today are Alan Stone and James Riley of the law firm of Milbank Tweed. Mr. Stone has been admitted pro hoc vitae and will be presenting our argument before the Court today.
Very well. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to see you again.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's good to see you as well. Happy to be here. May it please the Court. Your Honor, we are here today seeking reversal on two grounds. First, the trial court's opinion dismissing our case applied a pleading standard that is much higher than the reasonably conceivable standard adopted by this court in Century Mortgage last year. Second, the trial court erred in dismissing this case based on res judicata, reasoning that this action for the payment of interest was identical to an action for excessive fees that we brought previously in the Court of Chancery. We ask today that the court reverse the trial court's decision on both of these grounds.
Mr. Stone, I just want to make sure I understand your side's position. As I understand it, your claim is that the cause of action that you're asserting in the Superior Court case is different from the cause of action that was asserted in the Chancery case. In the Chancery case, it was a derivative action which challenged the fees or some of the fees that were paid by the defendants. And that claim, the Court of Chancery held, was barred by the no action clause. The claim that you're asserting here, if I'm correct, is a different claim, namely that it's a claim simply for interest owed, which falls under the exception to the no action clause, because the only claim that was dismissed in Chancery was the claim that fell under the no action clause. That cannot operate as res judicata because you're asserting a different cause of action here. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Is it also correct that the underlying assumption of that argument structure is that in the Superior Court action there would be no challenge at all to any of the fees that were actually and in fact paid by the trust? Is that correct? Let me say it differently.
Okay.
What I gather from your brief is that if this case were allowed to proceed in the Superior Court, your claim would accept as a given all of the fees that were paid, and the only argument would be that even accepting those fees, which resulted in a net zero interest or close to it, your claim would be that for independent reasons more interest was owed. Is that a fair statement?
Well, Your Honor, yes. I think it's a fair statement that we would not, in the lawsuit as it is pled today, be challenging the fees. I do think that in discovery we would necessarily need to know what those fees are.
Well, putting that to one side, whatever they were, you're making a binding representation that there would be no challenge to the fees that were actually paid.
Well, yes, we would, at least in the lawsuit that we've pled now, if we discovered during discovery that there were excessive fees paid, I think we would then, I think, leave open the option to try to proceed to attack those excessive fees, but we would be faced with the same difficulty we faced in Chancery, which is the no action clause.
Res judicata.
Res judicata, and the no action clause.
Right.
Well, a related question is, the Superior Court had some concern with the fact that your complaint didn't ask for a specific amount of money. And the reason you couldn't ask for a specific amount of money or interest owed is because you needed to get discovery, as you say, and ascertain the precise amount of interest that you contend was paid. And the Superior Court raised this concern that if, as Justice Jacobs said, it was simply a matter of interest not being paid that should have been paid, obviously it could be quantified and you'd get relief. But if the interest wasn't paid because you contend the fees were excessive, you'd be back to the same type of suit that was in the Court of Chancery. So, you know, the purpose of Justice Jacobs' question and mine is to try to make some bright line distinction, which you try to make in your brief, between this Superior Court action and the Court of Chancery action.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the idea that somehow because the interest payments are tied to the management fees, that we shouldn't be able to proceed with a claim for our interest without satisfying the requirements, the standing requirements under the No Action Clause, is one that bumps directly up against Section 6.09 and the Trust Indenture Act, which is an overriding policy here. So I think that the trial court's view that because somehow the management fees would be implicated in the calculation of interest and therefore this action too is barred by the No Action Clause is erroneous.
Could you have made a claim in Chancery before it was dismissed? I understand your argument as of the time it was filed. But before the case was dismissed, could you have made a claim for this interest?
Not for all of the interest that we're claiming now, but certainly as of the time that the Chancery Court action was dismissed, there had been some months without interest payments. There's no question about that. Part of the difficulty that we've had is a complete lack of information, despite attempting to get information. And so we didn't want to run off and file a suit for interest until a number of months went by and we knew that this was a pattern that was continuing.
So while the Chancery action was pending, your client was on notice that interest was due?
I think we were aware of the fact that interest had not been paid, yes, for some months, but...
There's a difference between had not been paid and legally due. Was your client on notice from its perspective that interest was legally due and owing from your...
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, I think that's a very difficult assessment for someone in the position of my client who doesn't have all the information about what the various, what was the state of the various elements that go into the payment of interest. So over the months that followed the dismissal of, well, even before the Chancery Court action was dismissed and following, my client assessed what was going on in the marketplace and what was going on with this particular trust in terms of money coming into it. And it was only after doing that kind of an analysis that it could make determination over several months that it believed that interest was not being paid.
Well, to follow up on Justice Ridgely's question, as you know, Delaware has a very broad res judicata rule. Under that doctrine, the cause of action that was actually raised and litigated to a final judgment is barred in a second lawsuit. But so too is any cause of action arising out of the same facts that could have been brought in the first action. And I think that's the concern, the other concern that we have. Could the claim that's being raised now in the Superior Court have been asserted in the Chancery action as an alternative cause of action? First cause of action being we're entitled to interest because the fees that were paid were too high, thereby reducing income. Alternatively, even if the fees were not too high, and are unassailable, we're still entitled to interest. Is that a, is that latter claim one that could have been brought in the Court of Chancery action?
I think knowing what my client knew then, it would have been difficult for it, as of the dismissal of the Court of Chancery, to bring that action.
And that's because?
Because it didn't have all of the information that it needed, which it was getting from the marketplace, not from the issuer or from the trust, in order to assess whether, putting aside whatever the management fees were, it had a reasonably conceivable basis for believing that interest was not being paid.
All right. So there would have been a Rule 11 problem, possibly, if that claim had been made at the Court of Chancery stage?
Yes, Your Honor. The other thing I would point out on that front, Your Honors, is that we are suing now for a different time period, for the period even after the Court of Chancery action was dismissed, and we could not have sued for the nonpayment of interest after that, obviously, at the time.
That would be the circumstance whenever there's a dismissal, isn't there? Wouldn't it? There's obviously a time cutoff as of the time.
There is, but I would say two things about that, Your Honor. One is that I think the Delaware cases recognize that that what is barred is, and I cite specifically to the LaPointe case, certainly Delaware recognizes that the transactional approach to res judicata, but the case also clearly holds that contractual rights that are triggered and pursued after the initial suit are not barred by claim preclusion. I would add to that that given the policy of the Trust Indenture Act, that holders should have an absolute right to sue for the payment of interest.
Well, that's the exception to the no action clause, the carve out, correct?
There's a contractual exception, 6.09.
Right.
But there's also the Trust Indenture Act that says that you can't, that issuers and trusts can't put impediments before the right of holders to sue for interest.
Is it your position that if this Superior Court action were allowed to proceed, that the interest, the right to interest, would flow only from some period of time or some date after the Chancery action was filed, or not?
We would limit our rights to after that date, and we so told the trial court.
All right. And my question is why? That is, on what basis? Is there a limitations problem?
There is no limitations problem. We were responding to the point that the appellees made in the trial court that that we could have brought a claim for interest as of the date of the dismissal of the Court of Chancery action. And our point is we're suing now for a different time period, for a period after that, and those are claims we clearly could not have brought.
And that's not because of any limitations problem, but because of some representation that was made to the Superior Court or the Court of Chancery?
It was an offer that we made to the Superior Court at oral argument that we would limit ourselves to suing for the date after the dismissal of the Court of Chancery case. But there is no limitations problem.
Did your limitation, again, was after the Court of Chancery action was filed or dismissed?
Dismissed, Your Honor.
Mr. Stone, the argument that you're making here, I assume, was made to Judge Silverman. That is, it's a different cause of action. We're not going to be challenging the fees that were paid, unlike, you know, what was asserted in the Court of Chancery if the action is allowed to proceed. That was argued.
We argued below that we were indifferent to the management fees that were paid.
You wouldn't challenge them.
I'm sorry?
You would not challenge those fees in computing what interest your client contends it's owed.
I don't think it was put to us that way, Your Honor.
Well, did you put it to the court that way?
No, we did not put it to the court that way. But had we been asked, I think we would have limited ourselves that in such a fashion. I think, again, our view is, however, that if we were to discover that they were paying themselves excessive fees, that's something that we would want to pursue with whatever avenue we could. Now, we understand that there's a...
All right, but that's compartmentally different from what you're now telling us is before the Superior Court. And all I'm asking is whether the Superior Court understood precisely what was before the court. Because
And I think the way we articulated it below was that our complaint is indifferent to the management fees that were paid. We are looking at this with the information that we have. We don't know what management fees were paid. We're looking at it with the information we have and saying...
Well, you're saying the court, that your position before, that you're taking here before us was communicated clearly in whatever form to the Superior Court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Then what, how, if at all, did the Superior Court address that argument in its opinion? That is, that the Superior Court knew that it had been told that there would be no challenge to the fees that, in fact, were paid for purposes of computing interest. How did the court respond to that?
The court responded to it by saying that our suit, that even we admitted at oral argument that in calculating the interest, the court would necessarily have to look at the management fees.
And that was a misunderstanding of your position? Or a correct statement of your position?
Well, we readily admitted that the court would have to look at management fees.
Yeah, to find out what in fact was paid.
Right. Right. And for that reason, the court said the two are intertwined, and therefore this is barred by the no action clause.
And your response is they may be intertwined factually, but they're not intertwined legally.
It's that, and it's also... I don't think that as a policy matter the court should allow issuers to present formulas for interest that are tied to other variables such that every time a holder brings an action for the payment of interest, the trust or the issuer goes into court and says, can't do that, you're barred by the no action clause.
Well, that may be an argument under the Trust Indenture Act, but is that a relevant argument for res judicata purposes? Or
I do think it is, Your Honor. I think there's an overarching policy concern here about not impeding the ability of holders under these indentures to bring actions to collect interest. And I think by presenting a formula that ties that interest to other things, an issuer should not be then in a position to say, you can't sue for interest because it's related to X, Y, and Z, and those are barred by the no action clause.
Can you, on the issue of Rule 11, can you tell me what you knew at the time of the filing of the Superior Court action that you did not know, perhaps not to the same extent, but to a lesser degree, prior to the dismissal of the Chancery action?
So, Your Honor, I think that those are issues of fact that are not in the record, and maybe they could be developed through discovery, but I can make representations, Your Honor. They're just not part of the record. And what we did, once we saw that several months had gone by without the payment of interest, is my client did an analysis of other similar trusts by the same issuer. They did an analysis of...
Well, that's in the briefs. You're saying that that's not in the record?
I'm saying that precisely what we did is not a matter of record. That is in the briefs because this is the argument that we made below.
Okay.
And it's reflected, our analysis is reflected itself in the complaint.
Well, are you telling us that you did not have the documents needed to make the analysis during the period that the Chancery suit was ongoing, or are you telling us that you had the documents but did not perform the analysis? By you, I mean your client.
Right. It's a little of both, Your Honor. For one, we didn't have all the documents because, in this case, the appellants were refusing to give us information, any information. The analysis itself, we didn't do that analysis until some months had passed without the payment of interest.
Mr. Stone, you've used up all of your time, but I stomped the clock with a minute and a half left, and that's what you'll have for a rebuttal.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Who's going to proceed next? It's a pleasure to see you also.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. Rebecca Butcher from Landis, Roth & Cobb on behalf of Appley U.S. Education Loan Trust 4, LLC, which we'll refer to as USELT for your purposes. With me today in the courtroom is Dan Rath and Jim Green from my office. Representing Appley Education Loan Trust 4, we have Kirk Wynn, Brian Rostocki, and John Cordry, all from Reed Smith LLP.
Welcome to all of you.
Appellees are reserving part of our argument for Mr. Gwynn to stand up and make an argument on behalf of Education Loan Trust 4.
The clock will switch to yellow when you have the 2 minutes you asked to reserve.
Thank you. The record before your honors has exhaustively argued the same issues somewhat over and over again, so I'll try and avoid repeating the things that are set forward in the briefs. But I'd like to focus on a couple of issues that you were just speaking about with Mr. Stone to start. And one of those is that their statement that they would not be challenging any excessive fees. But the complaint, as it's currently drafted, and the calculation that they did to arrive at the $900,000-plus that they're owed in interest for a portion of 2011 through 2012, does cap those fees.
Well, as I understood Mr. Stone's position, he's primarily asking for interest. If during discovery they find that the fees were, in their view, excessive, they're going to try to challenge the excessive fees. But they realize the prior ruling of the Court of Chancery may be problematic. So I didn't understand him to say he wasn't going to challenge excessive fees if he finds them. And as Justice Jacobs' question pointed out, that seemed to concern the Superior Court, because the Superior Court said, if you're going to leave the door open to challenging excessive fees, this case looks like the Court of Chancery case.
Understood. But the actual calculation performed in the complaint doesn't agree with the fees actually paid out of the trust based on the documents on which they rely.
So is that something for summary judgment or 12b-6?
I think it's something for 12b-6, because if the fundamental basis of their claim is disproved by the documents that they relied on, why should we have to go forward with discovery?
Well, Ms. Butcher, obviously that was a source of concern, but as I understood Mr. Stone's answer, they have made a binding representation that if the Superior Court action is allowed to proceed, they will not be challenging whatever fees were in fact paid for purposes of seeking relief in that action. Now, we either believe it or we don't, but let's assume that that is a reliable representation. What happens to your res judicata defense?
The res judicata defense? If they are not challenging fees?
Yes.
If they're not challenging fees, well, then first we have to take out all of the allegations with regard to their calculation.
All right. So you're saying that if that representation is reliable,
correct,
then the res judicata defense drops out, and we're now down to whether they have pled a proper claim for relief under Rule 12b-6?
I don't necessarily agree that the Let me rephrase that. No, I don't agree with that.
Okay.
Because the res judicata defense is not solely based on...
They could have brought that claim anyway, but didn't.
Right. They could have brought that claim anyway, okay. but didn't. If you're not talking about the actual calculations that they included, and we'll put them to the side because they use
okay.
a different fee number than they're supposed to.
I understand
to.
That argument.
Okay. So then you have...
Let me ask my question. If you're adhering or would intend to adhere to the argument that this claim, even if it's conceptually different, not covered by the no action clause, could have been raised as an alternative claim in the Court of Chancery, how do you respond to the other side's argument that, number one, they didn't have the documents that would have enabled them to make a claim that would have passed Rule 11, and secondly, they had not done the analysis that would have enabled them to ascertain that they had a claim for interest, putting to one side any thought about excessive fees?
Well, I don't believe that it's an entirely accurate representation of the history of the case, because the information on which they rely, the various non-calculation-based assertions that they've made, are the past performance of the trust, this particular trust, that it had been paying interest and then the interest dropped out. Certainly they had that information because they were investors, so they were receiving the interest payments. They knew that the interest payments for this trust had changed, so I don't think that that is something that was...
Well, we would have,
didn't have before.
If you're asking us to rule as a matter of law that the other side could have brought the claim as an alternative claim in the Court of Chancery, then the question becomes, what did the plaintiffs, RBC, know and when did they know it? So
right.
What does the record undisputably show about that?
The record undisputably shows that since October of 2009, RBC had been complaining that they were being underpaid their interest, not receiving all the interest that was due and owing, based on the fact that the market showed that this trust was not performing as other trusts have performed in the market.
But is that in the record?
It is. If you go to B-142 in USCLT's appendix, you'll see a letter from RBC to USCLT from October 30th of 2009 stating the second issue, separate and apart from excessive fees, separate and apart from excessive fees paid, is the calculation of the net loan rate. The net loan rate for each of the trusts is significantly below prevailing market rates for similar types of investments, and there are concerns whether it's being accurately calculated. That's from October of 2009.
How do the documents show that RBC knew that it had a claim for interest, assuming that there were no improper or excessive payment of fees?
They asserted they did.
Sorry?
They asserted they did.
They asserted?
From RBC said that.
Okay.
That's RBC's claim that they asserted more than a year before they filed the Chancery complaint.
They asserted that in a letter? Or?
They asserted that in a letter to USCLT and the trust. And they asserted again several months later in another letter.
Where is that in the record?
That appears in the record at the May 27, 2010 letter is at B-146 of USCLT's appendix, stating the NLR, the net loan rate for the trust, has been calculated incorrectly. Part of the incorrect calculation is the result of the payment of excessive administrative fees and operating fees, although there appear to be other errors resulting in an artificially low net loan rate. And then they once again raised it as a separate concern in the Chancery complaint at paragraph 47, which can be found at... which is found at A48 of theirs, of the appellant's.
So you're saying they made a in their complaint in Chancery the factual predicate for an interest claim but failed to seek that alternative relief?
They did not assert the facts in as much fulsome detail as they did here, but they asserted it as a separate basis for relief. And after oral argument on their motion to dismiss that we brought in the Chancery complaint, they again asserted it as a separate basis for relief.
Where is that in the record?
It's at B-151 in the appellant's appendix, where they state that the calculation of the NLR, the net loan rate, is incorrect for reasons in addition to the payment of excessive fees. For example, the net loan rate calculations for the ARS, their securities, are significantly below the prevailing market rates for similar types of investments.
Is it your position that that evidence that you just cited in response to Justice Ridgely's question compels the conclusion as a matter of law that RBC knew that it had a claim at the time that the Court of Chancery action was pending for precisely the relief that it's seeking here? That is, it knew that it had this cause of action that it later asserted in the Superior Court?
Yes.
Now, what about the different time period argument? Why doesn't that distinguish facts?
The issues that we're talking about are in terms of, once again, we're putting aside the specific allegations with regard to the 2011 calculation. These allegations are very general. They are based on performance, and all of them could have been raised at the time of the Chancery complaint had they developed that alternative.
But can you speak up or move the mic closer? I'm having trouble hearing you.
They all could have been raised at that time had they made it more made a more fulsome argument. They, with regard to those issues, there aren't new facts that have been alleged here for a different time period. So without new facts, why does
the Chancery rule on their separate argument relating to interest independent of the administrative fees?
It was not specifically addressed in the Chancery opinion.
And I guess your position is, however the interest payments were being calculated, have remained consistent, and to the extent they're alleging some type of improper calculation independent of the fees, they could have raised that in the Court of Chancery. And to the extent we're talking about different years, you would expect that if the calculation's the same, you're going to get whatever you get. So you really can't attack the calculation process because you had an opportunity to do that in the Court of Chancery.
I'm not saying they could never attack the calculation process. I'm saying they can't attack the calculation process based on these issues that they had the ability to raise at the time they brought their prior complaint.
Yeah, that's what I thought I said.
The other concern is whether those allegations would even state a claim under 6.09. And I don't believe that they do. When we're talking about the general
allegations. We are told that the complaint alleges a specific number representing the interest that would be owed to all of the security holders, even if one assumes that the fees that were in fact paid were proper. Why doesn't that dispose of the 12B6 argument?
Because it doesn't allege that.
Because it doesn't? Why doesn't it?
Because the fees that are alleged, their $46 million sum that they allege are the fees that went into their calculation, are not the fees that are set forth in the trustee statements on which they purport to rely. There's a $4 million difference
right.
The fees that are actually set forth in the trust
right,
standards
and that $4 million difference,
$5 million.
That $4 million difference your side attributes to the overpayment of fees similar to what was alleged in the Court of Chancery, correct?
Correct.
That may be an inference, but is that a dispositive inference, or is that one that may or may not be right, meaning that the 12B6 motion would have to be denied and the case would have to proceed to a discovery stage?
It is a 12B6 issue because it's not a statement of what our calculation is. I mean, obviously our calculation of the net loan rate is completely different than anything that's set forward in the complaint. But the claim that they're making that they are owed a specific amount of interest is not credible based on the fact that the documents on which they rely have a different number in them than the number they used in making their calculation. Why should we have to proceed on a complaint for interest being due and owing when the math isn't right? If they could just assert any number and just say, you know, okay, well, we say interest was $50 million
and
46. It's not a factual issue because it's not a dispute. The documents on which they rely do not agree with what they put in their complaint. It's not a credible, reliable representation.
Ms. Butcher, you went over your time a minute and a half, so when we get done with the entire argument, each side will have gotten the same extra amount of time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning again. It's a pleasure to have you with us. You have a total of 6 minutes. And the clock will become orange when you have a minute and a half.
Thank you. May it please the court, Kirk Wynn from Reed Smith on behalf of Bank of New York Mellon as indenture trustee. I was planning on focusing on three issues. One would be the issue raised by Your Honors, what did our BC know at the time of the dismissal of the Chancery Court litigation on December 6, 2011, and whether it could have brought a lawsuit. The other two issues that I'd like to focus on, of course, subject to whatever the court would like me to address, are that the allegations in the complaint are, in fact, inconsistent with the allegations on which RBC relies, and that is a motion for dismiss issue. And then lastly, that the 12B6 dismissal was with prejudice and is an adjudication on the merits, contrary to the distinction that RBC tries to draw in its papers regarding a dismissal with prejudice and an adjudication on the merits.
Well, let's take the last question first. A final judgment may operate as an adjudication of the merits. The question is the merits of what? And, you know, the argument that is made to us is that the only claim, the merits of which were before the Court of Chancery, was the claim that the fees that were paid were excessive, and therefore, and as a consequence of which the claim was found to be barred under the no-action clause.
Respectfully, Justice, I think that's a narrow construction of what was before the Chancery Court. The Chancery Court
made it clear in its own opinion that the claim that's being asserted now in Superior Court is not the claim that was before it. So on what basis do you say that that's narrow?
The prayer for relief in the Chancery Court complaint was for the court to, quote, order defendants to pay to plaintiff unpaid interest in an amount to be determined at trial, close quote. The theory in that case was excessive fees. The fact that other theories could have been available is relevant for res judicata. In other words, all the theories that could have been.
I understand that. That you wanted to talk about that as your first argument, but I interrupted you because you were making the argument, the separate argument, that the dismissal with prejudice was a final judgment as to the merits. And, you know, that I agree with that, but the merits of the claim that was being dismissed in Chancery did not encompass the claim that's being asserted in the Superior Court, or at least we are so told.
And the effect of res judicata, of course, is on claims that were or could have been brought.
All right. So
which circles back sort of to the first.
Okay, issue. So the third argument depends on whether we accept the first argument.
I think that's fair, Your
Honor. Let's turn to that.
The Superior Court, in its opinion, recognized that RBC could have sued for unpaid interest 6 days after interest would have been due under the documents, and I forget the particular date referenced by the court in its opinion, but the court, in its finding of res judicata, and that RBC could have brought this litigation before, could have asserted this claim in the Chancery Court, recognized that there are due dates for interest, if any interest is payable, and once they come and go, if there's a claim that interest should have been paid, it is accrued at that time period. When you look at the amended complaint that was submitted in the Superior Court, the allegations are that based on the performance of this trust, other trusts, another trust that was managed by U.S. Education Loan, but if you look at their performance, interest should have been paid since May of 2010. And that's in paragraphs 49 and 50 of that second amended complaint, or the amended complaint, it's appendix page 614. So they were alleging that interest should have been paid as far back as May of 2010.
The problem we have, I mean, we know that. The problem is whether they were making those assertions based on their argument that the fees that had been paid were excessive, or whether they were making that claim assuming the propriety of the fees.
Understood, Your Honor, but the question also has to be whether they had information available to do that. When you look at in the amended complaint, the information they're relying on and the performance of those other trusts, that's information that was available.
Well, that
the fact
gets,
that they didn't do
that gets way down into the factual weeds. It's not whether they knew. That is, the issue then becomes not whether RBC knew that it had the claim, but whether if it had done enough digging at the time, it might have been able to come up with that. Is that a claim that we can adjudicate here and appeal as a matter of law?
Well, Your Honor, I think, yes, once someone brings a claim, they should be charged with bringing whatever other claims relate to those underlying facts. If they were
if they know they have a claim.
Right. They asserted a claim for interest.
Yes, but for interest based on what? Excessive fees or based on something else?
Well, based on excessive fees in the Chancery Court, Your Honor. But
well, that doesn't get you a dismissal of the Superior Court case.
No, but when there's information available to which they could have also asserted their theory that interest was just due, they had that information available to them because it's the information they relied upon on later that was publicly available.
Mr. Gwynn, your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, responding to Ms. Butcher's point about the letters that she cites at B-141 and B-144, those letters reflect that RBC didn't have information about the net loan rate. And there's actually no mention of interest in the letters. Reading from the first letter that begins at B-141, page B-142, states, however, there is not sufficient transparency in how the NLR is calculated by the administrator of the trust to determine exactly what is causing the below-market NLR. And it continues a couple of paragraphs later, in the hopes of avoiding legal proceedings, we request that you promptly provide sufficient information to allow RBC to verify that the trusts are being properly administered. There's a similar statement at page B146 in the second letter. So the question of what we knew and when we knew it is not something that is in the record, and therefore we don't think that the trial court was in a position at the time to make a determination that we could have sued 6 days after the first interest payment
but
was missed.
But is that information, I take it, it's not in the record whether they responded to that request in the letters, is that correct?
No, in the second letter, it reflects that they didn't respond.
Okay. Is it in the record, or does the Chancery Court record reflect that there was discovery on that issue while that case was pending? Did you ask for that information?
We asked for that information, and it was turned down.
And was there a motion to compel?
Discovery hadn't begun because there was a motion to dismiss. We didn't get discovery. We asked by letter for this information and have been for years. And we, for years, didn't even get the quarterly trustee reports. And during the course of this litigation, for part of it, we didn't even get those. So a lot of this stems from us not having information. The basis for our complaint in Superior Court is based purely on market information.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And thank you all for your arguments. And the court will take the matter under advisement and recess.
Please rise.